owners are dealing with an interesting question right now. And that question is, do we push or do we not push? The NFL owners have tabled a vote on the potential banning of the tush push for more discussion to be had. According to to NFL sources, right, league sources, this from Kevin Seifert of ESPN, 16 NFL teams voted in support of the ban, meaning that the other 16 did not. League rules dictate that 24 of the 32 teams have to vote in favor of a proposal for it to take effect. So this is an interesting one. Of course, this all stems from back in March when the Green Bay Packers authored this proposal, put this forward, believing that the tush push should be banned or outlawed, or certain aspects of the tush push should be made illegal. The proposal that came from Green Bay written specifically for the play, unlike most proposals, and would prohibit any offensive player from immediately pushing a teammate who is lined up directly behind the snapper and received the snap. Meaning, if this was put in place, then you would theoretically still be able to tush push, but it would remove the push aspect, right? You could still have your offensive linemen lining up at that strange sort of 45-degree angle that the Eagles use, but you wouldn't have Saquon Barkley and Dallas Goedert and whoever else lining up either next to or behind Jalen Hurts to push him with greater momentum to move forward. Now, some of this is being thrown around as like, oh, they're trying to ban it because of a safety risk. Where's the evidence to support that? I'm not saying that I'm against the tush push being banned, right? The pushing part of the tush push. I'm not saying I'm against that being taken out of the game of football. But to try to use safety risks when you have no data to back it up feels like your argument's falling on deaf ears there, right? The NFL health and safety department that had zero data suggesting an injury of any kind that has resulted from the use of the tush push for the Philadelphia Eagles or any other team that has used it. The Bills and the Eagles are the teams that use it the most, the Eagles especially. According to NFL statistics, the tush push was used 101 times in 2024. The Eagles were 65 of those 101. It's an interesting discussion. The chairman of the committee, Rich McKay, said that the league generally frowns upon rule changes that target one or two teams, which this rule seemingly does, specifically targets the Eagles especially, but also the Buffalo Bills. Those two teams use it quite a bit. Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie was quoted as saying, "We've been very open to whatever data exists on the tush push, and there's just been no data that shows that it isn't a safe play. If it weren't, we wouldn't be pushing the tush push," pun intended, I'm sure. So yeah, I don't know. They're tabling this for the time being. I'm not sure when exactly it will be thrown back into discussion. The Bears chairman, George McCaskey, confirmed to ESPN on Wednesday that they did vote yes on the ban. For decades, there was a rule on the books that made it illegal to push the runner. It went away in 2004, and I always wondered why that happened. So maybe they're trying to advocate for that rule being re-implemented. Again, I would not be against that. Honestly, I would be for it. For the Philadelphia Eagles, it has been a massive, massive part of their success. In the last 3 years, for the Philadelphia Eagles, since they began to use the tush push regularly, they have scored 27 touchdowns and have accumulated 92 first downs just off of the use of that play on short yardage situations. This past season, they scored 11 touchdowns and had 32 first down conversions. Just this season. Nick Sirianni said Tuesday, quote, "It's an exciting play. It was really cool to hear some people talk about it this week and what they think of it. The excitement it brings to the game." Jacob, I'll bring you in here. You're a non-biased perspective to some extent. Do you find the tush push exciting? When you watch the tush push occur in a game, are you like, oh, that's that play really, you know, that gets you fired up?
I enjoy, I mean, I get it's an quote unquote unstoppable play, but it's created some funny moments, like when the Commanders linebacker tried to jump the snap count. And it's no different to me. Honestly, Brady had a quote unquote almost unstoppable sneak, quarterback sneak. Josh Allen had one off to the left side for the longest time until teams started figuring out, hey, that's where he was running all the time. And I mean, at the end of the day, if you can't stop it, and that's the whole reason you're trying to ban it, now there could be the whole player safety because people getting piled on. I don't even know if there's been an injury. I think there's been two reported injuries or one reported, but it wasn't even a serious injury that came from these. I find no reason to ban it.
I personally find it incredibly unexciting. I'm sorry. And for the NFL, they are an entertainment venue. It's an entertainment-based business. You are supposed to captivate your audience. And for me, there's nothing captivating about their use of the tush push. If they used it maybe a little bit more sparingly, I guess we could have the conversation. Teams use the quarterback sneak all the time, but certainly not to the extent that the Eagles use it all the time. We just saw the NFL change their rule regarding kickoffs, right? Trying to incentivize kicking the ball in that area between the goal line and the 20 for teams to return it. And for kickers to put it in that area, right? They've moved it from the 25-yard line to the 30. It will now be pushed out to the 35-yard line now is what will happen if a kicker gets a kickoff for a touchback. It will be moved to the 35 for the offense or the receiving team on their next offensive possession. So it incentivizes a kicker to try to put it in that zone to make it returnable, to make kickoffs exciting again, because they were very, very boring and have been for some time, pretty much since the day Devin Hester retired. They just haven't been the same. So I don't find this play incredibly exciting. So from the NFL standpoint, if you want an exciting product, trying to rid the game of those unexciting moments, this sort of feels like one of those. Somebody in the text line in 816 says, "I was originally against the tush push until I realized the defense can't push their tackles. Allow the defense to push and keep the tush push. Otherwise, ban it." Push their tackles. Like the offensive tackles? I guess I wasn't aware that that was a thing. Could be. I'm not sure. Again, the tush push is fine. I have a problem with the push. Because for a very, very long time in this league, the push was illegal. And it's one thing for me for it to be a push that occurs organically, right? Isaiah Pacheco gets an outside zone play, and he's running, and he's got a six-yard gain, and he gets stopped up in a pile. A mosh pit occurs, and Trey Smith and Creed Humphrey get behind the pile, and they push Isaiah Pacheco forward for another yard or two. Okay. Right? That occurs organically throughout the game of football. But my problem with the tush push is when the push is designed into the fabric of the play call. That I have an issue with. But just one man's opinion on the matter. 913-586-7965 is our number. Another 816. "What to do with MJ, boys? Quite the conundrum, a perplexing problem." Wow. First of all, kudos on three sentences in, and you've used words like conundrum and perplexing. Absolutely nailed it. did a great job reading your thesaurus today. I love it. His salary is $2.65 million this year. With over 1,500 at-bats, he's a career 200 or barely above 200 hitter. Can we win with him? Maybe not with this lineup, that courtesy of Raj and the Ozarks. You give him till the end of May. That's just my opinion, right? Maybe it's not specific, right? Maybe it's not May 30th or May, you know, that you're making that decision. But give him a little bit of an opportunity. He changed his stance. He's trying to get himself back in a form, getting himself back comfortable with that brand new stance, that brand new swing. Let's give it a little bit longer, right? Somebody in the text line earlier mentioned this, and I can't believe that I hadn't thought to say it, right? A lot of panic with this Royals team to start the year. Six games in, they're 2-4. Everybody in the AL Central is 2-4. So the whole division is off to a slow start. No reason to panic. The Twins aren't 5-1, right? The Tigers aren't 6-0. The Guardians aren't 4-2. Everybody in the Central's got the same exact record. Basically, the division is sitting at 0-0 right now. So let's give it a beat. Let's give it a beat. But I do agree. I would say you give MJ a little bit longer. Do I think that things are going to change in MJ Melendez's favor? If I was gun to my head, no, I don't think so. I don't think that MJ Melendez finishes the year as the Royals' everyday left fielder. But I think you have to give him an opportunity to prove that one way or the other. And in six games, you haven't done that. This is a make or break year for MJ. You allow him the opportunity to make it or break it. That's just one man's opinion on the matter. Dan in KCK says, hi, Logan. The Royals will have a great homestand. Dude, Dan, I hope you're right. I hope you're right, my guy. You know, my best friend and his wife are actually coming down this weekend. They're going to be staying at my wife and I's house for the first time. They're going to come see it. I'm super excited for them to come see our house. And we've talked about potentially going to a Royals game this weekend. I don't know if we will or not. The weather's kind of up in the air right now. Seems like we're going to get a lot of wind and rain and storms, and I'm not sure I want to get stuck at Kauffman in a weather delay, if I can help it. We got more messages in the text line. We'll get to those here when we come back, and a lot of them are in regards to the tush push. The conversation continues next here on After Hours. Logan Weber alongside Jacob Mustard. You're listening to 96.5 The Fan. That is our number here. After Hours on 96.5 The Fan. Logan Weber here with you. Jacob Mustard behind the glass producing our program tonight with you till 9 o'clock. We're talking about the NFL tabling the idea of banning the tush push after 16 teams approved, voted for the ban, and 16 did not. So they have tabled that discussion for the time being. No exact, I guess, timetable for when that discussion may get picked back up. But we've got some people that are, you know, for it, against it. I am more on the for side, but it's not heartbreaking for me if the tush push continues. Somebody a little bit ago was saying, I was originally against the tush push until I realized the defense can't push their tackles. Allow the defense to push and keep the tush push, otherwise ban it. And I didn't quite understand where they were coming from, and they clarified further that NFL rules, defensive tackles can't be pushed. So if the NFL were to somehow change the rules where in a tush push scenario, let's go with the Kansas City Chiefs as a primary example. Say you've got, you know, Jerry Tillery now and Chris Jones as your defensive tackles. Say Nick Bolton and Leo Chanel lined up behind them and pushed them into the offensive line as whoever was on the opposing side, whether it's Jalen Hurts or Josh Allen or whoever, is being pushed on the offensive side of the football, then you keep it. If not, ban the tush push. And that's an interesting thought. I had not, I did not, I admittedly was not aware of that rule that defensive tackles could not be pushed on a given play. I understand that. I get the safety standpoint from that. But again, it kind of goes back to what we've seen in modern sports in recent years, where rule changes have greatly benefited the scoring rather than the defending, right? Look at every major league baseball rule change in the last decade, from the banning of the shift to the crackdown on the, you know, the sticky tack or the substances that pitchers use, to the pitch clock and other things, right? It's all the ghost runner and extra innings and all. It's all seemingly, maybe some of it is pace of play, right? I would say that the pitch clock and the ghost runner and extras, that's more pace of play. But even still, those rule changes, while they may focus on pace of play, still skew towards the offensive side. In the NFL, rule change making defensive pass interference a spot foul rather than a 15-yard penalty and an automatic first down. It's now a spot, you know, 50-yard pass down the field. Quarterback underthrows it, makes contact with the DB. That's a 50-yard penalty and an automatic first down for the quarterback throwing a duck, right?
See, and I thought they made a good rule change when they allowed the review of pass interference and they quickly shut that down. I don't know how many were successful, but that helped the defense a lot of times more than the offensive side.
I would agree. But that's one of the few that I would say has been more of a benefit to defense versus offense. And I'm not sure if it's getting used all that much. It sounds like that's another NFL rule that could be coming down the pike or already has, is a stronger use of the replay system with pass interference situations.
Well, they did it for one season, then took it away.
Right.
And then, I mean, hopefully it's coming back.
It sounds as though it's coming back if it isn't already. So again, this feels like that, like the offense is allowed to push, but the defense isn't. I don't know. That feels, again, skewed towards the offense, which I understand. I get it. Believe me. Offense scores points, right? Offense generates fans. Offense gets people involved. People want to see touchdowns. They want to see home runs. They want to see doubles. They want to see tons of offense. Although the lack of defense is kind of what's causing the NBA to struggle a little bit right now, admittedly. I don't know. I'm always going to be a strong advocate for having good defense. I have to. I'm an Iowa football fan. I've been watching football without offense for 20 years. So, something to be said for that. Then again, I've watched Iowa basketball for the last 15 years have great offense and no defense. So, it's a very contradictory feeling for me. I don't know. Just one of those things. 913-586-7965 is our number. Real quickly, I guess, latest on Aaron Rodgers. I guess we all still wait around with bated breath if you want. I don't necessarily. I do not care. I could not care any less about what is going on with Aaron Rodgers. Does he go to Pittsburgh? Cool. Have fun on a 9-8 team that's not going to make any noise in the playoffs. Are the Vikings going to just submit and allow him to come to Minnesota? Because it's been a weird, like, Rodgers has been very hyper-fixated on the Vikings. He's been public with the fact that he's interested in joining the Vikings. And the Vikings were like, nah, I think we're going to go with J.J. McCarthy. And then a couple weeks later, J.J. McCarthy goes, nobody's told me that I'm the starter. Nobody said a word to me. And then the owner's like, well, you know, we might still be open to the idea of Aaron Rodgers. So which is it? I don't need the whiplash, Minnesota. You're just feeding into keeping Aaron Rodgers in the news cycle.
Well, they got to complete the Brett Favre saga.
I don't know how far into that saga you want to get. I mean, how far does Aaron Rodgers want to willingly put himself on the Brett Favre career trajectory, right? He already did Packers to the Jets. Aaron Rodgers had a little bit more success with the Jets than Rodgers did. Does, you know, he go to Minnesota? Rodgers took Minnesota to an NFC championship game, if we recall. And that was about all the further that it got. And then things got very unfortunate for him. So how deep down this rabbit hole do you want to get, Aaron? That's the question. And honestly, I really don't care what the answer is. I don't.
I don't think anyone does at this point.
I thought he should have retired 2 years ago, but just one man's opinion. We got about 30 minutes left in our program here tonight, After Hours on 96.5 The Fan. I want to spend some time here when we come back. I want to go over the Final Four. Yes, both of them. I want to discuss the women's Final Four, the men's Final Four. We'll do that coming up right here on the program tonight. Logan Weber alongside Jacob Mustard. 96.5 The Fan, your home for Kansas City sports. There's a lot of people out there that are seemingly upset about the men's and women's Final Four. That there aren't more Cinderellas or upsets. And I get that, right? I get that. We love seeing our Loyola Chicago's, our Florida Atlantic's, our Butler's, right? VCU's and Wichita State's and teams like that make those incredible runs that nobody saw coming, right? Those Cinderella stories. But I think it's fair to say that a lot of times those stories don't always end with a narrow loss, right? I mean, Butler, yeah, right? With those deep runs that they had with Gordon Hayward and those great teams and Ron Baker and Wichita State. But maybe I'm in the wrong on this. I don't know. I'm kind of excited for the field that we have for the men's and women's Final Four. Of course, on the men's side, for the first time since 2008, all four number one seeds won their regions and advanced to the Final Four. You've got an all-SEC matchup to kick things off on Saturday with Florida against Auburn. I think that game's going to be phenomenal. Surprisingly, ESPN actually has Florida as a 2.5-point favorite in this game. No, I know Auburn's a little bit banged up. They're first-team All-American. Their center kind of dealt with a little bit of an injury. As far as I understand, he will be available in this game. But, man, this one has all the makings of a very, very entertaining night of basketball. Both of these clubs, Florida and Auburn, fill it up. 83 points a game for the Tigers. Florida scores over 85 a night. Both teams shoot the ball well. They both rebound well. Two fairly good defensive teams. Florida's on a hell of a roll right now, though, right? I mean, they've won 10 in a row. They won the SEC tournament, and they've carried that momentum with them to this point in the year to get to a Final Four. They earned themselves that one seed by winning the SEC tournament and beating, you know, beating some really, really good teams down the stretch, right? I mean, they beat Mizzou, they beat Alabama, they beat Tennessee to win that SEC tournament. You look at these two teams during the course of the year, they only played once, and it was a road game for Florida. They had to go to Auburn, and the Gators won that game by 9. So in terms of the head-to-head, Florida's got them. But as we all know, with that typical cliche, it's hard to beat a team twice. And Auburn was the number one overall seed in this field for a reason. And the only real competition to Cooper Flagg for the Naismith Player of the Year is Johnny Broome from Auburn. 19-11. I mean, really, really impressive for the senior from Florida, which is kind of interesting. I mean, he's got 2 blocks a game this year. Tremendous rim protector. He can step outside and shoot it a little bit, although he's been a little bit more inconsistent with that this season. But a very, very impressive player. Florida has got some big bodies down in the low block, though. They've got a ton of depth down low, which could be very, very intriguing to watch in that one. And then the late game, Houston against Duke. Contrasting styles in a lot of respects, right? This Duke team, they like to fill it up. They love to get up and down the court. They score almost 84 points a game. They are one of the most efficient teams in the country from the field. They like to move the ball around. They average over 17 assists a game. These are two teams with the longest win. These are the two teams with the longest active winning streaks in college basketball. Duke's won 15 in a row. Houston's won 17 in a row. Houston, the winners of the Big 12. Duke, of course, won the ACC. But Houston defensively can get after it, dog. And what's funny, what's interesting about this Houston team is they're not the most efficient team from the floor. However, they are the most efficient team from the three-point line. They are the number one team in college basketball in two categories: points per game allowed and three-point shooting percentage. If they can be effective defensively, make life hard, maybe not so much on Cooper Flagg, because he's the sort of guy that you try to slow him down, but you're not going to shut him down, right? But if they can make life harder on, you know, on guys like Knipple or the Proctor kid, Tyrese Proctor, their point guard, they are going to be a much more difficult team to contend with. And if you're knocking down shots and you're making life harder for the surrounding pieces for Cooper Flagg and this Duke team, you could make this one a game, man. You could absolutely make this one a game. I'm very, very excited about the possibility of this one. But if Duke's shooting the ball well, Houston's going to have to try to keep pace. And while they score 74 a game, that's still 10 points a game less than what the Blue Devils have put on the board this year. Blue Devils, statistically, over the course of the year, are a slightly better rebounding team. They like to move the ball around, like I said. This one's going to be fun, man. I'm so excited about it, because I think these are the four best teams in college basketball. And it is not very often that we have an opportunity to see the four best teams in the sport competing for a championship, right? Typically, one has a bad night and gets knocked out a little bit sooner on in the year. I'm very, very excited. And then on the women's side, you've got the four best teams in women's college basketball that are in this field, right? You got one seeds in Texas, South Carolina, and UCLA, and then second seeded UConn. So of the final four in the two sports, men's and women's basketball, seven of the eight are one seeds, and the only one that isn't is a really high seeded two. So, and you know, maybe USC could have put themselves in a position to get to this final four if not for the injury to Juju Watkins, which is an absolute heartbreaker. But I'm excited about this field too, because this is a year in women's college basketball. One of the more fascinating things that we've watched is you're not seeing teams just absolutely dominate everybody on their way to a championship anymore. And I love that. It used to be, right, when early on in Gino Auriemma's career at UConn, with teams that included Diana Taurasi and Brianna Stewart, and you know, it was just like, okay, yeah, give it to them. When Candace Parker was at Tennessee, it was like, what's the point in the rest of us playing? When Skylar Diggins-Smith was at Notre Dame, yeah, that they're going to win a chip. It doesn't feel that way anymore. I mean, look back at these Elite Eight games in the women's side. Texas beat TCU by 11, right? Fairly tight game there throughout, especially in the first half. I mean, Texas led by one at the break and ended up coming, you know, putting it away in the really good third quarter, and then they end up putting it away in the fourth. UConn beat a Juju Watkins-less USC team 78-64. Duke lost to South Carolina by four, right? 4 points is all South Carolina was able to beat the Blue Devils by. And then UCLA was able to get past LSU by seven, despite 28 from Flaje Johnson. And, you know, a cool story around this UCLA team. First Final Four appearance in school history as a one seed. 34-2 this year. UConn's 35-3. South Carolina's 34-3. Texas 35-3. I think we're getting to see the eight best teams in these two fields between the men's and women's Final Four competing for a championship. And I know that that's there's no seven seed in there, right? You're not seeing a random team from the Valley get in, or I didn't expect this 8-seeded Florida Atlantic team to somehow make a run to a Final Four. Well, they'll play against San Diego State for a trip to a championship, right? It's a different sort of excitement. It's a different sort of fun where it's not so much about the Cinderella stories. It's not so much about the upsets and the, you know, it's about the best of the best competing and going at it, right? That's the beauty of the Super Bowl. That's the beauty of the World Series, right? And we're kind of getting to see that on both sides of college basketball this year. And I think there's something inherently exciting about that as well. 913-586-7965 is our number. We're going to take a break, come back, and wrap things up for you here on this Wednesday, April 2nd edition of After Hours with Logan Weber and Jacob Mustard, right here on your home for Kansas City Sports, 96.5 The Fan. Ovi's getting closer. Alex Ovechkin netted another goal tonight. The 892nd of his career, as he is now 3 goals away from breaking the all-time mark set by the legendary, the GOAT of hockey, Wayne Gretzky. 39-year-old Russian has scored 39 goals this season, which is tied for the second most by a player 39 or older in NHL history, behind Gordie Howe in 1968-69, who scored 44 for a guy older than age 39, which is incredibly impressive.
How many games do they have left?
It's a great question. Let me take a look. Again, I'm not one to claim to know a lot about hockey. I do know that he plays for the Washington Capitals. That I do know. So let's take a look at their schedule. They're currently still playing, and they will have 7 games after tonight. So he's got this one and 7 more full games to score at least 2. 2 would tie it. 3 would ultimately break it. Based off of the year that he's had this year, I can't imagine he's set on retiring, but who knows? Here's the crazy part. Is that he has now scored 892 career goals, which puts him in exclusive company, right? If he surpasses Gretzky. Alex Ovechkin in his career, right? Because the hockey has this strange statistical system where they have goals and assists, and they count as separate stats, but then they collectively come together for points.
Because it's so hard to score. It's just another statistical measure they can keep.
In Ovi's career, right, in his entire career, he has scored 1,615 points. Even if he breaks this record, he would still need over 1,000 more assists to surpass Wayne Gretzky in total points. He's got 1,615 total points, including those 891 goals that he's got. 892 now. Gretzky's got 2,857 points. What?
He was either scoring or he was the assist man. It is one of the most insane stats ever.
Yeah, I mean, he could set the high water mark for goals in a career, and he still would be behind Joe Sakic, Sidney Crosby, Mario Lemieux, Steve Yzerman, Marcel Dion, Ron Francis, Gordie Howe, Mark Messier, Jaromir Jagr, and Wayne Gretzky in total points. Because he's just he's not a huge assist guy in his career. This is absurd. It's absurd. In full season play, right, Gretzky, if he played in at least 72 games in a season, His career low for assists, 53. His career low if he played in at least 70 games. Ovi's career high in assists is 59. For your career high to be six more than somebody else's career low, mind-boggling, dude. Mind-boggling. And Gretzky, I mean, played for 20 years. Over an 82-game season for his career, Wayne Gretzky averaged 49 goals, 108 assists, 158 points. What? Again, I don't know much about hockey. That's absurd. That is absolutely insane.
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, and there still is to this day, debates per sport, who is the GOAT? There's not a debate in hockey.
Mm-mm. Now, golf, you can debate Jack Nicklaus versus Tiger. In basketball, you can debate LeBron versus MJ. You know, in the game of football, I don't feel like there's a ton of debate about it being Brady.
There was, but some, I think Brady solidified it.
Some may still try to throw Jerry Rice into the conversation. You know, not necessarily position by position, but just in the game of football. Yeah, hockey, the debate doesn't exist. Like, it's Wayne Gretzky and then everybody else, right? If you want to go with Jaromir Jagr, if you want to go with Ovi or Sidney Crosby or Gordie Howe, yeah, man, throw those names out there. They don't touch Gretzky. They just don't. I'm sorry, but a guy who set the NHL record for goals and somehow had twice as many assists in his career is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
They were running the offense through him. I mean, he was touching the puck, whether he was scoring it or the last touch before a teammate scored. It's one of those where, like, I know we see the Lakers running before the Doncic trade, and everything was running through LeBron, his off-the-court measurements, and you see that through multiple different point forwards or point guards and Doncic on the Mavs. But it's crazy when you have the offense flow through one person.
I knew this was going to happen the minute I started talking about hockey. I knew I was going to mispronounce a name. Somebody says it's Steve Yzerman. I apologize. Again, sort of ignorant to the game of hockey, but you can recognize greatness when you see it. Yeah, Gretzky won 4 Stanley Cups. 10 Art Ross trophies. He won 9 Hart Memorial trophies. He was a 15-time All-Star. Yeah. Sorry. To be that much of a focal point and still be as successful as he was and to still have the level of team success that he had, extraordinary. Extraordinary. I didn't mention baseball as a part of the GOAT debate because that's another sport that I feel like has a strong debate that rages, right? Some say Babe Ruth, some say Ken Griffey. You got an opinion? Who you think, Jacob? Just briefly here. We got a few minutes, seconds left.
You know, I love the steroid era.
Yeah.
You know, pick a handful from there.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat, right? I figured I'd wait till towards the end of the segment, maybe to avoid a little bit of heat. Barry Bonds is the best baseball player of all time. Sorry, steroids or not, that's my opinion. Best guy to ever pick up a baseball bat. He's unbelievable. Absolutely unreal.
Give him a torpedo bat.
Woo-wee. I'm curious what the science behind that eventually shows us. We'll see. That'll do it for tonight's program. For producer Jacob Mustard, I'm Logan Weber. Thank you guys for joining us. We'll be with you next time right here on After Hours on 96.5 The Fan.